Okay, let's just start this now. When I can find my, I recently downloaded the new version of iTunes because it forces you to do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, no matter what you do, it's going to force you to do it. But every time it does it, you have to get used to a new GUI or whatever, a new interface.
Yeah, and see what they've gotten rid of from the last
version. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow, that was like. Sorry, I blew everybody out of the back of their living room. So.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence, based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
I'm not even going to let that play out because that's just going to take just too goddamn long. After all the delays we've had here. Micah, can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, good. So for some reason, in continuation of our talk, our short interview the other week, we've got more technical problems or had. Suddenly he wasn't showing up on my Skype, and I don't know why. So sorry about that, but, you know, that's what happens when you do radio for free. So, and the audience seems not to mind or not to care that much, as long, and most of them listen to it on podcast anyway. Is that what happens on yours?
Yeah, Jim. Yeah, and I have to say also, I mean, you know, following our ill-fated attempt to try and talk last time.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not surprised that we couldn't connect on Skype again.
Yeah.
It seems like it's always something going on. And you know, that same evening, I was also supposed to later in the evening go on another radio program. And as a result of my internet and my phone line going out, I wasn't able to do that. And then it happened again a week later, so I'm sure, knock on wood, that we won't have any more interruptions tonight.
Yeah, of course not. If anybody listening doesn't know who Micah Hanks is, then you shouldn't be listening to the show. However, I will do a sort of introduction. He's runs the Graylian Report, and the Graylian Report... Oh, is your podcast also called the Graylian Report? It is, isn't it?
Yeah, I just figured I'd keep things simple.
Yeah, exactly. And author most recently of a book on the ghost rocket phenomenon called Ghost Rockets. And also another very important book, UFO Singularity. And then I think one on a haunting you had. And, it goes back. You've got at least four, right?
Yeah, there are four books. And, of course, you know, I'm getting to a point where I think I'll have the time to start working on number five. If I could, I'd do like Nick Redfern and write three or four a year.
Yeah, Nick, whenever he writes a book, he sends a copy to me, and then he writes a comment like another one from the book factory, or, you know, don't turn, you must have turned around again because here's another book.
Yeah.
And every time he writes one, I have him on and we talk, and we end up not talking, we talk about probably a third of the time about the book. I did not post the short conversation we had a couple of weeks ago, because I wanted to have this full conversation on. I may combine the two. I do not know. There may be some repeat. I don't know. And I talked to you, like, I think something like 2 or 3 years ago or more. It's up on the Radio Mysterioso site. And I don't remember what we talked about, but there's so many new things to talk about now. Do you want to talk about your book or... background or shoot the shit or topical stuff? What do you want to talk about first? I'm gonna let you decide.
I'm always a big fan of shooting the shit. You know, I'm from, you know, the Southeast, so, you know, although that can be open in Pandora's box too, Greg. So, you know, might as well find out what's going on in the world right now. How goes it?
It's going okay. Let's see. If we don't want to be Shooting the shit can be topical. When I wrote to you a little while ago on Facebook, I asked about... you first mentioned the Malaysian Airlines flight, and it's fun seeing all the crazy theories coming out about it. I haven't heard anything really, you know, that's weird, that's credible, as usual. What have you heard, and what do you think's going on with it?
Well, you know, it's a pretty complex situation, and I did a little blog piece that I called an estimate of the situation that I put up at MicahHanks.com. You know, I've seen everything, and of course, the latest theories are now looking at the pilots. You know, they're looking at the pilots. Greg, there was this one of the two pilots, the two primary pilots, had this extremely elaborate flight simulator in his home. Now, you, of course, being a pilot, have you seen these stories about this?
Not about the simulator, no. The first thing I read was the Ask the Pilot blog, which I like very much. I can't remember the name of the gentleman that does it, but he's a pilot for an international airline, I think United or something. And he was saying he couldn't figure out what the hell was going on, and he'd been flying. I mean, he knew people who flew those, the 777, I think it was, new Boeing. It was also the same model that I think it was Korean Airlines like hit the runway there in San Francisco and crashed. So he was saying there's nothing really horribly that could, you know, the only thing that went wrong with that plane was battery stuff to begin with, because the batteries were overheating. But that wasn't the problem, he said. He was pretty sure that it was some kind of foul play. Either foul play or something that was controllable, like it was a controlled thing. That's what he thought, being an airline pilot. And from my point of view, I only have to defer to him, because this goes into areas that I don't really know anything about. I don't know too much about, you know, how pilots are tracked, except for by radar. When I fly, I'm tracked by radar. And through air traffic control, that kind of, you know, there's a little transponder in your plane, and it pings back your location to various radars, or not your location, the identification of your plane and its altitude. So it had, you know, obviously they had that, and then when it went below the civilian radar, the military radar tracked a little bit further. But because of the weirdness of what it did and the strange maneuvers it went through, they kind of think that there was a human factor going on, not a mechanical one. Everything pointed towards that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that seems to be the situation with this latest issue about the pilot and the. And when I, by the way, say flight simulator, I don't just mean like he had like a PC hooked up with some software. I mean, apparently they said it was extremely elaborate with multiple screens and everything. I mean, literally to simulate the flight experience, you know, piloting a commercial aircraft. But yeah. As I understand, there are 25 countries now helping look for this thing. You know, China's deployed real-time satellites that they're trying to use to try and locate it. There have been civilians who are being crowdsourced, essentially, to help with the search. And you know, yeah, and one of the most interesting things to me, I think, is that a couple of the stories that have emerged are extremely strange, and one of them reads it has to do with the obsessive component, you know, with regard to the believed obsessive traits that one of the pilots may have had. One of the other things, and I'll come back to that one here in just a moment, but one of the other things that comes up in the news feed, if you go looking right now, and I'll go to like Google News every few hours and everything, because I've followed this story pretty, you know, closely, Greg.
Yeah.
And I look at what the stories are coming up as, and they always change each time. But another was a CBS News story from about 6 hours ago that reads, "Pilot suicide, a taboo topic in past crash probes." I didn't even know about this particular crash, but apparently even after TWA Flight 800, there was an Egyptian Airlines aircraft that had flown from the West Coast and had landed at JFK International Airport, leaving from JFK, flying over Long Island Sound in roughly the same general vicinity that TWA Flight 800 went down, which I talk about in my book, The Ghost Rockets. This aircraft goes down into the ocean, just nosedives. And the Egyptian government had said, well, we don't have the resources to investigate, because here's the situation, and I'm sure you know this, Greg, being a pilot, but if an aircraft like that goes down in international waters, it's generally the job of the craft's country of origin to look into the investigation unless they request assistance. And in this case, they did. Egyptians requested assistance from the National Transportation Safety Board here in the United States, but I think the actual request was answered by the FBI, who took over the investigation, simply because it was so close off the east coast of the United States. Well, the FBI begins looking into this Egyptian Airlines crash, and what they determine is they think that it was a suicide, and that the pilot, according to the black box, he had apparently been very calm, and he had repeated, I put my faith in God, and drove this thing into the ground. Well, the Egyptian government said that was completely unacceptable. They decided to get back in on it and start doing the investigation themselves. They ruled mechanical failure. U.S. officials said that it was a suicide that brought down the entire plane. So, you know, from time to time you hear strange stuff. I didn't even know about that. And having left from and crashed into the same general area that TWA Flight 800 infamously went down,
yeah,
it gave me chills. But this other story, Malaysia Airlines flight search authorities probe whether pilots' obsessive political views played a role in the disappearance. Now we're seeing supposedly that one of the two pilots may have had what are described as obsessive political views, an obsessive supporter of Malaysian opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim. So who knows what's really going on here? But as the weeks have gone on, I mean, it's unprecedented, you know, to have gone 6-7 days with a plane missing. They're kind of hard to lose, you know?
Yeah. Well, the fact that he had a very good simulator in his house could mean anything up to and including the fact that you can accrue time, cockpit time, up to a certain amount in a simulator. Also, he might want to just keep, maybe he had low air time and wanted to keep his hours up. I have no idea, but a simulator can be used as official air time, at least in the United States, only up to a certain point. So I don't know if I put too much stock in him having a really good simulator in his house. One, he's a pilot. He can afford it. And two, it's his job. So about the political views, I have no idea. Oh, I remember this thing about the Egyptian pilot, too. And yeah. I believe it was the United States said that it was a suicide, and the Egyptian said it was not a suicide. The reason he was saying that is because there was something wrong with the plane, and he was trying to fix it, and he was saying prayers while he was trying to keep the plane aloft. So that was the argument between the United States and the Egyptian government, I believe.
Which I wondered about, because, I mean, again, the repetitive, I put my trust in God, I put my faith in God. I mean, you know, if you were experiencing mechanical failure and you believe that your plane might crash, if you're a religious person and you have maintained composure, that's precisely what you'd be saying.
Right.
I don't think that that's necessarily hard evidence that there was a suicide, which interestingly was not really referred to as terrorism, if I remember correctly.
And, right.
And Greg, remember, after 9/11, the FBI redefined terrorism.
Yeah.
According to their own statements and books and everything. And so that definition and the attitude toward, you know, the terror that we face, you know, terrorist acts in the world today, it's a very interesting thing. In that case, they referred to it as suicide, not as a terror act. So, again, it was kind of strange. And whether or not you want to assert conspiracy, you know, I'm somebody who, and I'm sure you probably agree, I'm somebody who feels that the term conspiracy theory is overtly weaponized these days. It has been ever since the Kennedy assassination, and the media outlets love to throw around conspiracy theory. I've seen some goofy ones. I mean, I have to say there was a lot of talk, although there is an official statement by MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, that they do not endorse any ufological theory in relation to the disappearance of the craft. There have been a couple of MUFON members and even state directors who have tried to endorse the idea that the plane was abducted. But, you know, I mean, in my book, The Ghost Rockets, you know, I look at a couple of aircraft crashes and disappearances that I definitely would say are ufological, because it is believed that they may have been impacted or collided with an object. But the object being unidentified could be anything. It's projectile-like, but an unidentified object, if it's flying through the air, is an unidentified flying object. And so, much the same, if there are people who conspired to take this plane, take control of it, land it someplace, take people hostage, crash it into the ocean, or anything like that. And there was a forethought behind this, you know, a plan to carry this out. That, too, is also a conspiracy. And so,
yeah, well, 9/11 was a conspiracy, and everybody agrees it was. Just the extent of it.
Yeah. And it's funny to me, brother, that, you know, so many people, you know, especially in the mainstream, they utilize these weaponized versions of these terms, which really have very little often to do with the proper use of those terms at all.
Yeah, I love
when I see people talking about UFOs and they say aliens, extraterrestrials. I love it when a abduction researcher And we lost a pretty good one just, I think, 2 days ago. Roger Lear, you know, the implant specialist. But
yeah,
love it when an abduction researcher is called a ufologist. Some abduction researchers have little or no interest in the mechanics, you know, that are supposed to be acting behind a flying saucer or other exotic aircraft. They're interested specifically in abduction.
Yeah.
But again, there's the broad usage term that may not necessarily fail in the head. So.
Ah, great. Now he's cutting out. Can you hear me still?
I can. Hopefully okay. You can hear me.
Okay, there we go. Well, if you are at all familiar with any sphere of study, expertise, your job, as soon as you see something reported about on in the news, you immediately know how inaccurate it is, for the most part, when they get down to the nitty-gritty of things. So I don't think that almost any media outlet has a really good record in that regard. And then a lot of them are just lazy. I'm sure. Are you still there?
I am indeed.
Yeah. A lot of them are just, you know, reporters are just lazy, like most people are. They just don't bother to go check something. They don't bother to check, you know, double check something or, you know, get a second opinion, or they just rely on press releases, etc. Which actually brings up something, because I was looking at the Gray Alien site and you had an article on the Battle of Los Angeles, which is a subject near and dear to my heart. And you mentioned that there was a report somewhere that somebody had mentioned that there was an object that was butterfly shaped. Now, that I had never heard until you mentioned it. And you said that you had seen it in a couple different places, and that it had come from, Red Pill Junkie said it had possibly come from a report of something in San Diego around the same time, where people said they had seen something that was bat or moth or butterfly shaped in the sky over San Diego in 1946, I think. So actually it wasn't the same time. It's 5 years later.
Yeah, you know, the thing about that...
conflation, I think that's called.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of see this sort of thing happening a lot in a lot of these reports. I've always been very interested in the Battle of Los Angeles. And, I mean, I went from being someone who, at the outset, was really compelled by whatever could remain aloft for an hour and a half and be fired upon with heavy artillery and not come down, to looking and digging, honestly, a little more deeply for official narratives that... I mean, it is known that there were, without question, some meteorological balloons that would have been in that area at that time. And I can't help but wonder if possibly some of the objects that were fired at were indeed what we know to have been in the sky around that time, meteorological balloons. In the chaos and the confusion, there could have been any number of things going on, maybe even multiple scenarios. But I think that may contribute to some of it. One thing that's always bothered me, though, is that there was an initial report that an aircraft may have actually crashed and caused property damage in the Los Angeles area. So that, you know, you don't see a whole lot of. And I wonder now if that is like the modern equivalent of, you know, the initial reports of the Newtown shooting, saying that there were two shooters and that one of them had run into the woods. And now, of course, we know that wasn't the case. And there could have been a general misreporting. I don't know. But I always found it interesting that there was a reference to an aircraft going down during that Los Angeles air raid. Now, with regard to there being a butterfly-shaped anything, this is really interesting, because this gets kind of into the realm of what our buddy Red Pill Junkie calls synchromysticism, I think. You know, and in the blog sphere, a lot of the 4TN writers will kind of latch on to one idea, and they'll kind of start drawing parallels between one or another. And one of the favorite... you know, whipping Fortians or whipping creatures, you know, or what I call Fortian folk devils. So, I mean, yeah. One of the favorites in the genre is the Mothman. And people love to, you know, kind of invoke parallels between Mothman or butterfly shapes, you know, and things like this, Lorenzen's, you know, butterfly effect or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
With regard to the air raid of Los Angeles there, you know, or the Battle of Los Angeles, as it's more popularly referred, there were some, you know, alleged reports of a butterfly-shaped aircraft, and they were attributed to the Reno Evening Gazette. And so I actually accessed, you know, my family Ancestry.com account, because my dad's an avid amateur genealogist. And I managed to get a copy of the actual newspaper and read the thing cover to cover. I could find no mention of that in that newspaper.
Yeah.
Which got me thinking, you know, Greg, it got me thinking, and I kind of got bitten by the bug, and I thought, you know, I'm going to go back and look at as many of these old reports from these initial encounters as I can. Next, you know, moths being on my mind as they were, I went and looked at Mothman. I went to the Pacific Standard, I think was the newspaper. Of course, many of them carried it because it was an AP report that had been written by Mary Heyer, of course, who was famously portrayed by Laura Linney in the film Mothman Prophecies. But she was a journalist who had worked with John Keel pretty closely. And Mary had written this initial report about the Millette, and the other name is slipping my mind, but it was the two young couples that had been traveling near the TNT power plant facility, or the TNT facility, rather, the World War II TNT plant there near Point Pleasant.
Yeah, the abandoned one, yeah.
When they had their initial encounter with whatever it was that they saw there by the plant, it was incredible, Greg, because if you dig up that old report, you know, modern folklore tells us of this moth flying along and pacing their car at 80 or, you know, 90 miles an hour. The last line, quoting the young Mr. Millette in that article, was quite different. He says, quote, "It was an awkward runner." And I'm thinking, oh, interesting. So this initial report of Mothman describes this creature, whatever it was, keeping up with them and chasing them bipedally, not flying. Which was, of course, very different from what they said later. But even John Keel came back around later and said, you know, whatever the case may be, there was something going on weird in West Virginia. But I began to suppose that there was something more than just a sighting of a big bird-like creature. In fact, there was what he called an abominable swamp slob.
kind of well, thing. He's the one, I think, in Mothman Prophecies that describes the thing flying in that initial sighting. I believe that's in the book.
It is, yeah, and see, that's the interesting thing is that I think what we learn from this is that Keel began to revise his own opinions about some of these things, and if you look back at some of the reports, they don't tell precisely what the conventional narrative that we have would have us believe, you know. So I think it's important sometimes to look back at these things. Kevin Randall, I have a lot of respect for Kevin, and he's a good researcher, and he's become a lot more skeptical, especially of the Roswell stuff in recent years. But Kevin said a while back, he says, you know, I see a lot of these young whippersnappers. That was the term he used. The young whippersnappers that, you know, look at the old cases. But, you know, he says, we old, you know, old timers, we've done a lot of research already. There doesn't need to be all that, you know, looking back at these old cases. And I think that that's a twofold, statement of twofold importance. He's talking, I think, one about maybe, you know, younger bloggers who are just looking for something to write about, and they may, pardon the expression, but regurgitate an old story that's interesting from time to time just to have something to blog about.
Yeah.
Which is harmless, but it's not really doing anything to advance the field. And yet, by the same token, as we often see, Greg, you know, we can look back at some of those old reports from time to time, look more closely at what the newspaper articles and things have read. And I have had to, in many instances, you know, even with some of the old, you know, quote unquote older researchers, I'm an old soul. I feel like I'm older than all of them. You know, my back pain and all that. No, I'm kidding. But sometimes, yeah, oh, God, you know, you're only as young as you feel. Yeah, I feel like I'm 150. No. But I have had instances, though, where even some of my favorite people, I've had to say, you know, what you wrote right there, if you look back, it's not entirely in keeping with what the initial early reports are. Now, how do we reconcile with that? In other words, I think sometimes it's important to look back at some of these things because through the lens of modern technology and the availability of transcripts and microfilms and things, God, we can do anything with the internet, and we can also learn a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I've even gone to... I was doing research for Weird California. I went to the L.A. Public Library and looked up at least two local papers, the L.A. Times and the Mirror, for that exact date, and read the original initial reports and the subsequent ones over the next two or three days. No, there is not one mention of anything butterfly-shaped in the local papers.
Right.
It does mention, and there's no mention of anything crashing except for shells landing on people's houses and possibly killing some. Maybe, I don't think anybody was killed, but I think somebody died from a heart attack. That's the only report that I saw of anybody dying. But yeah, it as far as the subsequent reporting of the Battle of L.A., so-called, apart from this butterfly thing, which I didn't know about, I haven't really seen anything that's been conflated onto the story. When I did read your piece of research on it, the only thing I could think of beside what Red Pill found out was people have taken the famous photograph that appeared in the L.A. Times. I believe that is an L.A. Times photograph, the one everybody sees with all the searchlights. Mm-hmm. I think Bruce McAbee did this, notably. And they did an analysis with Photoshop or some kind of photo software to see if they could tease anything out of the middle of that picture. And there are all kinds of different shapes. The main one was, you know, the people saw was probably... is some big oval-shaped object, which really is doesn't really tell you anything except for that's what the camera looks like it was looking at, where all those searchlights were crossing. That could be due to all kinds of things. But I've seen photo analysis of that thing where there's a kind of a blob-like object in the middle, depending on how you change the level of the luminance that you're looking at where those searchlights cross. And, you know, I guess at some point you might be able to see some kind of a blob that might be moth or butterfly shaped. I don't know. But that's the only other thing I could think of was just, you know, the subsequent photo analyses done and what they might have concluded from that. And like I said, I don't know where that butterfly thing came from. It was a surprise to me to read it.
I tracked it back as best I could tell to a pretty obscure little website. I mean, it wasn't anything flashy at all. And unfortunately, I'd seen a couple of the crypto bloggers kind of carrying the story and quoting it. And, you know, I won't name names, but I mean, some pretty good researchers. And unfortunately, you see this happen from time to time in this field. People, they don't take enough time to really dig into what they're looking at. And I think we're all guilty of that from time to time, because sometimes in the immediacy of trying to get a blog post out, I mean, you've blogged for years, you've written, you've published a magazine, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Sometimes when you're on a deadline, there's so much that you're supposed to, as a matter of fact, I'm on a crypto deadline right now for New Page Books, which I just remembered as I'm sitting here talking. That on my to-do list to do again, since I didn't do it today. In the immediacy of trying to get things done, sometimes people gloss over things, and, you know, I don't look at that as an inexcusable offense. I frankly think that that's human nature. And
you can't, because you've written books and you know what it's like.
Yeah, I mean, really. I mean, I tell you, I know what it's like to be raked over the coals and to look back at a silly mistake and say, and unfortunately, I've never made any hugely grave mistakes. I think my bigger mistakes, unfortunately, are, the backlash that comes from pointing out somebody else's mistake, you know, because I'm not trying to be a little cocky, you know, little, you know, idiot, you know, but... I think that, you know, a lot of us have been in that situation. You probably have too, Greg, you know, where when you have to, for the sake of the, and I use this word carefully, the sanctity of presenting credible information about the UFO phenomenon or anything else. I mean, the old sacred cows do have to be thrown out. And I'm really troubled when I have to sit down with somebody who's telling me, oh gosh, you know, any number of what I really
you got this wrong. So how can I trust anything else? It's like, well, yeah, then why do you watch TV news, read the paper, read any kind of media when occasionally they make a mistake? Does that mean that they're wrong all the time? You can't trust anything they say? Does that mean you point me to a book or an article or anything where everything is 100% right?
Exactly. And that's the whole thing.
It's not an exact science. It's as good as you can make it at the time.
And that's interesting. And actually, now, of course, I know I'm on your show. You're the host, but we're shooting the bull here a little bit. And so I want to ask you a question, if you don't mind. Because
No. I expect you to ask me questions because I talk too much anyway. So go right ahead.
Remember who you're talking to. No, I've said this before. And, you know, I mean, this is the first true redundancy from the last attempt at trying to do this interview. As I said before, I'll say it again. It's always really cool just to be able to, you know, catch up and talk with you and Nick Redfern are among my two favorite guys, you know, that I correspond with in this field, you know, and we don't do it enough. I mean, we're all busy. So when I get a chance, I love just, you know, catching up and talking about all this. And in relation to the question about, well, you know, what can be trusted and if a person writes this or that, you know, what data and what details can be led and can be, you know, relied upon. I've always been interested in those Southern California airship reports from the 1890s. So many people have said that they are in likelihood newspaper hoaxes, and not to try and prove another unknown quantity with another quantity that has nothing to do with it. But I noticed that people, for instance, say the same thing, Greg, about giant skeleton reports. And a friend of mine, a buddy and I, went on an ancient alien cruise back in January, and I gave a brief lecture on giant skeletons. And funny enough, David Hatcher Childress, who've written a lot about this over the years, there in the front row watching this this presentation. I pointed out that there were, in conjunction with a number of the old newspaper articles that discussed these discoveries and even some of the researchers who found them, that you can actually trace, and in three instances, actually, the lecture featured the Graham Chittenden and also DeHart jaw skulls or skull fragments. The DeHart jaw, of course, being a very large jaw. These are all very large skeletal remains that were found. Most modern skeptics have tried to always say that you can't believe those old newspaper reports. In many instances, I've managed to corroborate the newspaper report and the individuals involved with data maintained by the Smithsonian. So what does that have to do with the airships of the 1890s? Well, you know, J. Allen Danilek and a few others have written extensively about these reports, and they talk about the fact that, you know, some of those Southern California, I guess you'd call them UFO reports, that term didn't exist at the time, but that's what they were, if they were credible. They involved county officials, you know, they involved, I think, the mayor, you know, the deputy sheriff. Some people have asserted that those reports may be more legitimate than modern researchers have given them credit. So, of course, you having operated in that area, you know, Greg, what is your feeling about those airship reports from the 1890s?
Well, I don't know if there's any that are specifically geographically flap-like centered on Southern California. I believe the first one was actually from Northern California, and I think it was might have been Oakland or at least the East Bay of San Francisco, as it was acknowledged as probably the first airship, quote-unquote, report from the 1890s. I believe it was 1896 or something like that. And then subsequently it spread across the country. Yes, a lot of them can be, I believe, attributed to, you know, people trying to get papers trying to get circulation up. I mean, there was that moon hoax with the New York Herald or something like that, with New York Sun. I can't remember what it was, but it, in the late 1800s, turn of the century, there was a story what's his name? Herschel. I can't remember the astronomer's first name. But they had attributed a report to him saying that he had seen people and living things on the moon, and that through his telescope, and that had become a huge craze, and then, you know, it had gone on for weeks until the rival paper found out that it was a hoax. Apparently people didn't care, though. People didn't really. They just liked the story. But by saying that, I'm saying that I don't put it past a lot of newspapers in the especially and at least in the 19th and early 20th centuries to print things they knew to be false just to get a circulation up. However, the mistake made by a lot of people and by people that are fundamentalist skeptic type people is that they say all of them are that like that, and I don't think that at all. What I would think, and this is probably what you would think because we admire and read the same people, is that people would occasionally see something exceedingly strange and possibly involving some humanoid type entity, and the only cultural thing they had to put in that box was people flying in an airship, because they'd probably heard about some, you know, a balloon or an airship or people talking about such things, and so that's the little box they put it in. And you know, for now, until I find out something different, I'm content to say that at least some of them probably involve something strange. I mean, there were UFO reports before that. They go ask Albert Rosales or anybody, you know, read Jacques Vallée's latest book. They go back for centuries. So this is just, you know, I think a modern version of that. And the reports in the paper are just the ones that are true, quote unquote true, or close to being true, have to do with the cultural baggage of the time, if that makes any sense.
Oh, completely. Yeah. You know, Vallée, again, is probably my favorite. And it's so funny because Race Hobbs, My dear friend, and of course he's the program director of the KGRA radio network. I do a Sunday night show on the network there. It's a really good network too, because I mean, unlike so many of these, and not to, you know, pick on certain people, you know, because of course, you know, Kill Radio over there in Los Angeles has a really good host by the name of Greg Bishop. Did it lose you, by the way? Okay, you're there. Yeah, I was hearing
you drift a bit too. Sometimes I'm getting a good signal, sometimes not. But I can understand everything you say, so we'll leave it how it is right now until it gets horrible. Then we'll switch to, if it does, we'll switch to cell phone.
Yeah, No problem. Yeah, you got it. Actually, I've got a landline that might even work better if we need to. So,
okay.
But Race, you know, we've got Richard Dolan on the network, and of course, you know, there are other people, Mac Maloney. So it's a really cool situation, and a lot of the time it facilitates interesting conversation. Race and I were talking earlier this evening, and Travis Walton came up, and then Rendlesham. And I always say to people, you know, if you really want an interesting perspective on Travis Walton's story or on Rendlesham, read what Jacques Vallée has written. Specifically, read that book, Revelations, the third in the Alien Contact trilogy, the Contract trilogy. Yeah, that's right. That's right. This out now before they take your, you know, your sperm or your ova or whatever and everything for hybridization. Now they have you sign a contract. No. But, you know, Anomalous Books released the Alien Contact trilogy, as they called them, which were, of course, Dimensions, and then I think the second one was Confrontations, A Scientist's Search for Alien Life, and then finally Revelations, which it's my favorite. Well, I don't know. Confrontations is damn good, but it's a toss-up between that one and Revelations.
Yeah.
And Revelations is a really, really interesting book because Vallée takes a decidedly skeptical attitude toward a lot of these things, but doesn't go about it in a way that he tries to debunk these cases. It's a very different kind of skepticism, a lot more like the kind of skepticism I espouse, you know, or that you would. And Vallée...
Yeah, where do you think we got it from, partially?
I learned a lot about skepticism from reading Vallée. I mean, I read... You know, I own what's his name? Is it Robert Todd Carroll's Skeptics Dictionary? I don't agree with a lot of that, but in order to try and get a perspective on all these things, I own a lot of books that are both of the really truly skeptical. I own Philip Klass's books. I've got all Philip Klass stuff. You know,
me too.
I've read all of this. You know, I think it's important for balance to do that. But you know, Vallée, people overlook the fact that Vallée, in addition to just in general being brilliant, he presented a very, very, very methodically well-balanced, you know, skepticism, and was never dismissive or rude. That's what I loved about him, is he could be so eloquent in deconstructing the bullshit, essentially, that somebody would put out
from time to time.
And I love that about him. But his approach to the what would you call it, Greg? I guess the psychological, or the, if not even psychological, just the, I mean, the interpretation of various phenomena in human terms relative to what humans have experienced, an experiential kind of interpretation of phenomena.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And yeah, so exactly what you're saying about those early airship reports, it could be that there was something, but that what was reported was not in reality the something that was observed.
Yeah, or the person that observed it didn't really know what terms to put it in, except for as a, you know, as an airship with pilots in it that were human looking. And then, you know, then it goes to the further filter of, as we were talking before, a media person writing a story about something of which he has no experience with, doesn't really know anything about, and has to take the person's word for it and then interpret it for his readers in a way that they're going to understand.
Right.
So in the midst of all of that, it's an airship with a, you know, with some kind of internal combustion or steam engine in it, which would kind of be impossible to use with something that heavy. I mean, you couldn't really keep a steam engine up in the air with hydrogen or helium or whatever. Although there's other ideas about what was going on with the airships that my friend Walter Bosley can talk about.
Right. Well,
but,
you know,
it just remains for me a... It's a lot more, well, the whole UFO thing remains a lot more psychological, and that's about the biggest handle we have on it. And when you say that, people say, well, then you think it's all in the brain, all in the mind. It's like everything's all in the mind. But what we're talking about here is something that's so far out of everybody's normal life experience that they don't really have anything to do with, you know, they can't do anything with except hook it on the metaphors that are around, maybe even subconsciously.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. I mean, to try and wrap one's head around that. Now, you know, taking things in a slightly different direction with the airships, and this is something that I've just been fascinated with lately. It may have been Anthony Bregaglia. I'm not sure. I'm trying to remember the blogger, but on one of the websites, somebody had linked to a patent that they'd found, and I could probably dig this up. It was a U.S. patent that had originated out of Southern California for a heavier-than-air ship, and it was essentially a long cylindrical object with a great big kind of conical nose cone. And it had these wings that opened off the sides when the craft moved aloft. I think it was partially carried aloft by helium, but there were other technologies that were proposed for the employment of getting this aircraft into the air.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, this thing, when you look at the actual images and you look at the actual proposed designs, what this thing looked an awful lot like, rather than a, you know, like a blimp or a dirigible or anything like that, this thing resembled the kinds of stuff that turns up in the 1940s, specifically in 1946 when, and I talk about this in the book, The Ghost Rockets, Captain Jack Puckett had been flying over Florida. He was headed, I think he was the chief of or the assistant of Tactical Air Command, but he'd been headed to MacDill Air Force Base in August of 1946. And as he and his crew are flying along, they see this huge, by all intents and purposes, it was a huge rocket type thing. They said that it was about twice the body of this thing was twice the fuselage of a, you know, like a B-52 bomber. I think that they'd said that it had no wings, but that there was what appeared to be a exhaust trail coming out of the back as it were being propelled by rocket force, and it had two rows of illuminated portholes down the side.
Oh, yeah, I remember this sighting. I'm pretty sure I do. I've seen drawings of it, I think.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, I mean, and I don't want to make a tenuous parallel, but the description of that craft is at least remotely similar to these patent designs that turned up in the late 1890s, and you know, I've always been interested in, for instance, what J. Allen Danilek, he wrote a book, I think, called The Great Airship Mystery of 1897, although I think the sightings took place between late 96 and early 1897. In the book, he puts forward a very speculative, and he calls it a very speculative theory, that involves the idea that maybe that there was a nascent technology around that time that was being put into use by someone privately. It seems very hard to believe that someone outside of government agencies could employ an advanced, you know, variety of aviation technology, and that this would not have been employed during the war years, although there are certain reports of UFOs and strange aircraft that occurred before and after, and even during the Second World War. If we look at the Ghost Flyers and then subsequently what I pick up with in 1946, starting the same year that Jack Puckett saw this thing over Florida, the ghost rocket reports that began in Sweden and other parts of Scandinavia immediately after the war. It's just fascinating to me that there are these cases where technology that tends to just be a few years ahead of what is known to exist will show up and has continuously done so throughout the history of obscure aviation and UFO reports. And that, I can't wrap my head around that, Greg. You know, it's just one of the weirdest damn things because the alternative to the extraterrestrial hypothesis, if you don't want to go so far as to do what Vallée has done and entertain an interdimensional idea, is to go back in the other direction and say, the things are from here, but who the hell's behind that? Who has had that technology? Who's been developing incredible, exotic varieties of technology behind the scenes, maybe for the last 100 years or more? And that's a really weird idea and entirely speculative, but I mean, there is some substance behind that speculation. When we look at these reports, when we look at these documents, when we look at, again, something like what Jack Puckett talked about, he certainly wasn't the only person who saw the exact same craft identified almost detail for detail. It was seen over France. It was seen again in the United States, the Charles and Whitted encounter that I talk about in the Ghost Rockets. There are numerous reports that describe these rocket-like vehicles that are larger than commercial aircraft. They're like the fuselage of a very large aircraft without wings being, you know, thrust forward by a rocket. I mean, what the hell is that?
it's what people put together in their minds when they saw something they couldn't make any sense of at the time. I that would be my first. That's my pet theory. But yeah, as you say about secret technologies, there's one. There's an idea that there's a lot of military technology that isn't really mentioned to us or talked to us. Told to the public at large for somewhere between 10 and 20 or more years before it has outlived its usefulness as a secret weapon. And then you can get on the other side, like the parallel civilization side, a la maybe Mac Tonys and the crypto-terrestrials, and there's some other civilization parallel to us that has mastered time, space, or at least way to fool people into thinking they're seeing something that they're not. That's another idea. But the thing is, you bring all these ideas together, and not one of them applies in every case. It just doesn't work that way, which is why it's hard for me to stick to any theory about anything except for a multi-theory, where you've got a theory that works with some sightings and some aspects of the UFO phenomenon, but not all of them. And you can't really get away from that. Actually, that was a question I was going to ask you. I haven't read your UFO Singularity, and I should, and I would like to, but I would figure that you still there?
I am indeed, okay. Sir, yes.
One of the things that you deal with is some sort of unified field theory for not only UFOs, but a lot of other paranormal things, things that fall under the paranormal banner. And maybe there's something there. Maybe there's an answer there. Something that is common to all these things, besides what I think it is, which is the human mind. But what do you think about that? That if there was, could be anything that could explain most of these things we were talking about, what might you think that would be?
Oh, gosh. I mean, well, again, you know, it gets really into the realm of speculation. It's funny because people hear me talking about this stuff and half of them go, oh, Micah, Hanks, that guy is such a skeptic, you know. And then the others are like, oh, gosh, that guy, you know, he'll believe anything. And it's really a funny thing when you are able to equally, with equal precision, you piss off both camps.
Yeah.
with the UFO Singularity, the genesis of that book is a rather strange one. And to put it concisely so that people understand what's happening here, I actually do two podcasts and then also the radio program. And the two podcasts, we've mentioned the radio show already, but I mean, Graylian Report is the one podcast. And then there's also one called Middle Theory at the website, middletheory.com, which the co-host, Christopher McCollum, although he and I do more, you know, current affairs and news and even a little sports and stuff like that on that show, he introduced me to a guy who he had corresponded with years ago named Benjamin Goertzel, PhD. He's an artificial intelligence expert. And so I interviewed Ben Goertzel, and we just wanted to do a show. I just had, almost glossing over the subject, just wanted to do a show one night on the first incarnation of the Micah Hanks radio program that, God, was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. I wanted to do a show one night on artificial intelligence. And then the idea of robots taking over, basically, like we see in the films.
Yeah.
That was, in a strange way, the precursor to my introduction to the idea of singularity or technological singularity. And then later it was also brought to my attention by a colleague of mine, a very brilliant man by the name of Dr. Maxim Kammerer. And then also my brother Caleb Hanks, who occasionally co-hosts my program with me. He's just really into the singularity stuff. And I'm thinking, what is all this? Are we talking about AI? No. We're talking about transhumanism, which is a really, really, really contentious subject.
Yeah.
I had begun a while back to consider, you know, for instance, people always talk about extraterrestrial biological entities and things like this. And I'd always thought, wouldn't it be more easily achieved if one wants to consider space flight, if, you know, robotic life forms, if you want to call them life, we could call them sentient AIs. Well, if these were the inhabitants within these UFO craft, that would eliminate a lot of the issues that we presume that we would face if we were trying to substantiate the argument that ETs could be visiting planet Earth,
mm-hmm.
Which is, in essence, you know, Greg, I mean, this is like what we see in the Transformers films. You know, we see an intelligence, they don't even know where they come from, but they are an artificial intelligence, and they have a mechanical substructure, you know, that they are, you know, obviously very formidable with. They're battle bots, but they can also travel through space and withstand the rigors of space travel that a biological entity could not. So I began to look at the robotic and the artificial intelligence component to all this some time ago, and I had no knowledge of what singularity was, and so immediately when I became familiar with some of the popular singularity writers, the likes of Ray Kurzweil and others, I started saying, well, where is the I didn't expect them to write about UFOs.
Yeah.
But I wondered, well, where is the speculation about alien life? Because if we're to assume that human beings would go through a stage of development where we would vastly and rapidly increase our potentials both intellectually and physically, And of course, as Kurzweil's supposing, if a technology like this is achievable within the next few, you know, decades, then I had to presume that any intelligence elsewhere out there, that it would, they wouldn't even have to be significantly more advanced than us, in terms of the actual, you know, years ahead of us that they are.
Only slightly.
Yeah, exactly. We talk about UFOs. I've heard Stanton Friedman say so many times we're talking about a technology that may be maybe thousands of years ahead of us. And I'm thinking, if they're thousands of years ahead of us, you know, they're not going to be flying around in a metal tin can. We're talking about something that's going to be so technologically advanced that we may not be able to perceive it fully, which does, you know, jumping ahead for a moment, get into the realm of the interdimensional high strangeness that Vallée and others have written about. So
it will be magic to us, as Arthur C. Clarke said.
Exactly. And boy, do I ever quote that in the book. You know, and that's the whole thing. When you observe, Clarke was so brilliant. You know, and when you observe any technology, as he had, you know, said, I'm paraphrasing him, you know, something that is significantly more advanced than the technological capabilities of the observing civilization, it will appear as though it is magical. You know, how do we define magic? Something that defies nature, right? Well,
or what we think is nature at the time, yes.
I think the limitations of nature, you know, the boundaries of nature.
Be
it. So for me, I wanted to incorporate one chapter into a book that was going to be called The UFO Reality. This is what I pitched to my publishers. They asked me, you know, you should write a UFO book. And this is New Page in New York. And so I said, well, you know, let's do a book that looks very broadly at the UFO phenomenon. And there was going to be one chapter about all this, you know, what we call a singularity component. And to define that concisely, singularity simply means the creation of artificial intelligence. But it's more complex than that simple statement, because in addition to the creation of artificial forms of intelligence, humans may be able to, you know, utilize what we would call intelligence amplification, IA, rather than AI, in which we actually represent the advanced intelligence that is computer-generated or computer-enhanced and whatnot and so forth. So the publishers got back with me and they said, it looks like a great book. Why don't you write the whole book about what this one chapter is based on? Let's call the whole damn thing The UFO Singularity. I didn't like the title per se, but they said, would you be interested in looking more deeply at that subject? Yeah. So that's really, Greg, what led to that book. But what was so cool about doing that is that I was asked to write a book that was going to be inherently speculative.
Yeah.
I consider it in many regards a very skeptical book, because I don't really advocate an extraterrestrial hypothesis or anything that most people really would append to the UFO phenomenon today.
Mm-hmm.
I take a very divergent kind of approach. It is indeed inspired by Vallée and a few other researchers. But, you know, again, some of the things that I propose in that book, I mean, I don't think that anyone's ever really tried to append to ufology. And you know, I don't expect everybody's going to look at it and go, oh, wow, you're really onto something. Some people, of course, the greatest criticism for the book was that, you know, singularity is something that people look at skeptically today, you know, across the board. Many have said that it's almost like a religion in some of its facets. And by employing a singularitarian component to the UFO phenomenon, which before he died, I know for a fact that Mac Tonies was beginning to do, and he, had he lived, would have continued to do, They had basically accused me of, you know, trying to, you know, cash in on a popular idea, a meme, and trying to float UFO ideas on that popular meme to rejuvenate it and make it more interesting for and palpable for a younger audience. And I'm thinking, you know, if that's what I was trying to do, I would have said UFO.
Oh, you're cutting out again.
Oh, sure.
If that's what you were trying to do, then what? That's where you'd cut out.
If that's what I was trying to do, I would probably, you know, try and say that UFOs were piloted by Honey Boo Boo or something ridiculous. I mean, there are 100 million ways that you could make the UFO subject more palpable aside from just trying to present an honest interpretation of it, which is what I always try and do. And just, again, to come back to
you talk about sophistry, that's basically using sophistry to accuse you of using sophistry.
Mm-hmm. Red Pill Junkie often has said to me, you know, Micah, you should remind the detractors. And I, by the way, tell you or any other ufologist, and I'm even hesitant to say ufologist anymore.
I don't use that term anymore.
Boy, again, this is why I like talking with you, man. I've had to unmarry myself from all that. You know, I don't call myself that. That term just as well has been weaponized. You know, I'm just a researcher. That's it. But Red Pill Junkie said, you know, tell the detractors, if you were just trying to make money doing this, for instance, you could be working on Wall Street. You could be doing anything.
You could be what you should do is either start a publishing empire or start making TVs and movie shows, TV shows and movies, because those are the only people that really make money off the UFO subject.
Yeah, and the thing is, and that's another reason, you know, people are like, oh, it's just a matter of time, Micah. You know, you're going to be doing TV before long. You just wait. They're going to contact you. I won't lie to you, Greg. I, on average, about at least five times a year, I'm contacted by television companies either asking for consultation, one-offs, or we've got a new idea for a reality series. I've never taken up a single one of those offers. And as altruistic as I'd love for that to sound, I mean, frankly, I have pursued some of them. I haven't turned them down outright in a many, at least maybe, you know, a third of the cases where someone comes to me and says, you know, we'd like to talk. I have pursued it with them, but what they don't like, the, you know, production staff that I guess are involved in these things.
Wait, can you wait a second?
Yes, sir.
What they don't like is that you don't give them something that they want to hear that sounds good as a soundbite, right?
Yeah, that, or I'm not willing to sit there and, you know, for instance, they'll say, well, what experiences have you had? But would you be willing to say this or that on the camera?
Could yeah.
you? Oh, you know, how many times have they called you, Greg, by the way?
About the same amount of times they have called you, and I have the exact same experience with every single one of them. And most yeah. of the time they're going to call up and say, well, I'd really like to talk to you about this project. And so I'll talk to them for 5 or 10 minutes, and I'd say, how much more free information do you want out of me?
I knew it.
Because yeah. I've spent a lot of time putting all this together and, you know, and I don't begrudge you doing your TV show. I think it's a great idea. But everything I'm telling you now, you can find on the internet. You can find in stuff I've written and stuff that Micah's written, the stuff that Nick's written. Anybody, there's your siren, so you know you're on Radio Mysterioso. You can find all this stuff online. Now, if you want more, then hire me on as a consultant, and I will tell you as much as you want to know. Other than that, I don't like being vacuum cleaned for information so somebody can make money off research that I've done.
Yeah.
Especially if it's stuff that I actually had to do actual, real, you know, original research on, and not just stuff where I've read up on it and stuff that can no longer be found online or can't yet or whatever, just because I'm really into it. But, yeah, for by and large, it's... I equivocate too much. I think that's the biggest complaint that I've had. I'll say, well, what, do you think it's this? And I'll say, yeah, sometimes. And they look at you like, what do you mean sometimes? Well, don't you have a specific, you know, opinion about this? And it's like, yeah, my specific opinion is that there's something that isn't human that interacts with us occasionally. Past that, I don't have a specific opinion.
I love that statement, though, Greg, because, I mean, again, I saw this book on eschatology years ago that was subtitled The Science of Ultimates.
Yeah.
And the science of dealing with ultimates is any interaction that you have generally with you know, a media, you know, or if not someone representing, you know, a media agency, a hardline believer. And a believer can also be a skeptic, you know, a skeptical believer.
Yeah.
That's a belief form all unto itself. And again, you know, I love it when I'm having a conversation with somebody and they say, well, you don't really believe anything, do you? You just don't want to make anybody mad. And I say, no, 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 no. Now, what it is that in order to understand the complexities of what we're trying to discuss, as soon as you commit to a, well, I don't know what it is, so this one looks like the best option. This is what I believe. You are limiting yourself, or you are ruling out certain possibilities that are not in keeping with the A or B that you've chosen. I don't think things have to be A or B or black or white or night or day or life or death. There, unfortunately, in this world, the real world that we live in, folks, there is a lot of gray area. Now, that may not apply to your morals or your principles or scruples or your, you know, faith-based beliefs and things like that, or the attitudes that govern your acceptable interactions with others and the world around you on a day-to-day basis. Sure, there have to be ultimates in those circumstances. But when we're especially dealing with, as you just said, Greg, the potential for something that may indeed be interaction humankind is having with something that is not so human, it's very difficult to play the same A-B game. And that's what I've found, and I just don't do it, you know? Well, I mentioned earlier a podcast, really quickly, I should say, to Christopher McCollum and I do, called Middle Theory.
Yeah.
The name is actually derived from the middle range theory of law, because Chris is actually a law school student. But you know, this is inherent to our entire philosophy. He and I are very much the same, and we apply a very similar philosophy – to politics or anything else that we study, as soon as you see only right or left or day or night or this or that, you know, you limit yourself. And so with ufology, I mean, the most important thing I've learned is not to draw a specific conclusion in the absence of evidence. Now, when you've got the evidence, that's a totally different thing.
Yes, and that evidence may change.
Yeah, but that evidence almost always changes. Yeah, that's why they call it circumstantial evidence.
Yeah. It's interesting you call it middle theory. That's exact, 100%, same reason why my friends and I called the magazine The Excluded Middle.
Uh-huh, yeah. See, whatever, what was I telling you?
From, 1991 onwards, I think, for 10 years we did the magazine. But, yeah, it was based on my friend Peter Stenzel had a radio show. He had a syndicated radio show for a while called Little City in Space, based on, you know, the idea that some people in middle America sometime in the 1960s decided to launch their own space city, and they just kept adding to it, and it was like this alternate city orbiting the Earth. It was very influenced by Firesign Theater. However, every once in a while, they would have an ad, like an ad for some fake product. And there, you know, it was a parody of some, you know, thing that we knew about all the time. It'd be a parody of, you know, money-making schemes or whatever. But it was based in this orbiting city. However, one of them was an ad for robots that wanted to be more human. You know, you think you're too much of a robot. You think you think in and, you know, either-or terms too much. This course will teach you to be more human, to think less in absolutes. And at the end of the ad, the last line in the ad, Peter said, and he'd written, was "Discover the secrets of the excluded middle."
Uh-huh.
And that's where the name of the magazine came from, because we were trying to think of a good name for the magazine. And it's like, I said, Peter, you know that thing you wrote? And we all agreed that was probably the best one. And it basically, because all you can do, basically, is if you think there's something going on, which you and I do, and most people we think do, to varying degrees, as you've just said, the worst thing you could possibly do, especially with UFOs or any paranormal thing, something that we don't have a theory that explains that's repeatable yet, the worst thing you can do is lock yourself into any facet of that and say, well, this is it. Which is why a lot of people say, as soon as somebody says, you know, I know what the UFO thing is, and I know, you know, I've got the answer, run as quickly as you can in the other direction.
Exactly. And look at the answers that people have brought forward over the years, you know. I think the closest that I'm comfortable to referring to as an answer that I've, you know, seen.
Is there a rumbling noise on your end?
I'm sorry?
Is there a roaring or rumbling noise? Every once in a while I hear something that sounds like a jet going over wherever you're at.
Gosh, well, I don't hear it on my end, but, you know, it very well be somewhere in the subspace between us.
I guess it is. It's a very Keelian noise.
Now, if you need to reconnect with me, let me know. I may just double check and make sure that little automatically adjust thing isn't. There we go. Is that better?
Yeah. Right now it's great.
Excellent. We'll just roll with that.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
That's okay. Yeah. The closest I've come to finding something that I would, with any degree of comfort, say that I believe are the, although I disagree with some of them now, funny enough, these are the criteria that were presented by, mostly by Jacques Vallée. I think at certain times J. Allen Hynek had endorsed this, but it was the justifications for the less likelihood of there being an extraterrestrial component behind the UFO phenomenon. Vallée, of course, it talked about the number of reports far outweighed the necessity for a survey of a planet and all these kinds of things. I like the approach because it did take into consideration the data and what the data seems to indicate at the time that Vallée was writing this, which I think first espoused in confrontations but presented previously at a conference. This would have originated around the late 80s or the early 90s, with the idea stemming back, I think, even further. Now, I mentioned I like this because, again, this was based on extensive data retrieved not just from the Project Blue Book files but also from UFO eyewitness databases and personal documents kept by Hynek and, of course, by Vallée. They did a very good job documenting the information and then trying to make sense of the data. Something that, frankly, and Greg, God almighty, I've talked about this for years. We've got organizations like the Mutual UFO Network. They collect data ad nauseum about UFOs, but how much interpretation? With all the computer science and statistical availability of data that we have to us, available to us via the World Wide Web, how much interpretation of that collected data is done? Virtually none. Well, you know, Vallée was maybe the first serious researcher, in my opinion, that really tried to collect that data and do an interpretive analysis.
Yeah.
The flaws, on the other hand, of course, are largely philosophical. When we talk about, well, you know, a spacefaring civilization wouldn't have to visit Earth as often as UFO reports occur in order to conduct a survey, well, that's also a very anthropological argument. I mean, yeah. We're basing that on our own understanding of humanity. Can we assert those same or project those same intentions, values, or necessities onto an extraterrestrial civilization? Maybe not. So there are problems with Vallée's interpretations, and of course, nothing's inherently perfect. There are always going to be flaws in logic, but at very least it was a statistical analysis based on data that had been collected. I wish today, if nothing else can be done, that all the damned data that we have about UFOs could be more carefully interpreted and statistically, literally on the basis of what statistical likelihoods, maybe Bayesian logic would help us determine in terms of inherent likelihoods, what we may be dealing with. We may be able to come to a determination utilizing modern computer science that we couldn't do a few decades ago that really would give us a fairer estimate of the situation in regard to UFOs and what they may be. I don't know, but I suspect that we'd do a better job now than we have done in the past.
Yeah. That's come up before on the show, and I've talked about it with some of the other guests. The fact that there's all this data, there's data that's sitting around that hasn't been entered, such as all the old records from the APRO, which are in a storage facility in Phoenix right now, I believe still there, thousands and thousands and thousands of reports.
What storage facility is that, by the way?
It's like a place where just any of those places where they just give you a space and you just throw all your stuff in there and you close it up with a lock, just like a garage.
Really?
Yeah. It's owned by a couple. Chris O'Brien knows who they are.
Huh.
And he's in contact with them, and they're still trying to figure out who can take all these. I think they want to do something with them. They somehow got them after Coral and Jim Lorenz and died. And they want to do something with them. But getting all these records entered into some kind of database that everybody has access to, everyone, by internet, or at least by request, and not refusing people access to the data, and running them not only in the ways you've talked about, but in ways that where you start asking really strange, out-of-the-way, stupid, off-kilter questions of the data and seeing what it supports. And then also on top of that, expanding the way that they collect the data, meaning what kind of questions do you ask? Don't just ask what time of day it was, how big it was, you know, where were you, what direction were you facing, all that. No, ask what's your family history of mental illness, which is an obvious one, which would be, I guess, kind of scare some people. What is your heritage? Where does your family, you know, what's your family ancestry?
What is your favorite color?
Yes. Dumb things like that. And follow-ups, blood type, stuff like that. And follow-ups, like a week later, a month later, a year later, what happened in your life? How did it make you feel? Has your view of the world changed since then? Do people treat you differently? What is your family life like? Are you noticing, you know, what would be called psychic episodes? All kinds of questions like that that have never been asked because there's a rush to be very, quote-unquote, scientific. And to most people, scientific is a bunch of guys standing around in lab coats taking measurements of things. Well, this isn't just measurements of things. It's affecting people's psychology and their personalities and their interpersonal relationships, and that should be in the questionnaires as well.
What is so funny to me, though, is that virtually every question that you just asked, are those not included in, for instance, a study with psychedelics? For instance, a synthetic form of psilocybin that's administered to participants in a study at Johns Hopkins University.
Yeah.
Think about it. You know, have you experienced what you believe to be precognition? How is your family life? You know, literally, what is your favorite color? I mean, you know, are you happier or are you more sad? Do you feel more spiritual? All these kind of questions.
Mm-hmm.
those are the precise kind of things that would probably be asked of someone, and actually in many instances that have been asked during official DEA-approved studies with regard to hallucinations that alter a person's state of consciousness. In many regards, the UFO experience, even in a technical sense, probably elicits something very close to an altered state of consciousness. You know, whether it induces shock, whether it causes a person's extreme change in worldview, all these kinds of things. If those sorts of questions can be applied to people who have had a induced experience, those who have had a random one in what we can only call nature, whether or not there's a natural component to UFO phenomenon, you know, in their natural environment, they're walking down the street, they see a light in the sky, and they've had this experience. Why that same series of questions couldn't be asked of that individual in an experiential way, it just blows my mind, because those same questions are asked of people, you know, in various studies that may seem unrelated, but I think that there's a lot of parallel between those areas. And Rick Strassman's research, of course, with his DMT, the Spirit Molecule book, showed a lot of that, especially in relation to there being parallels between the alleged psychonaut experiences and the alien abduction phenomenon.
Yeah, when that book came out, I went around evangelizing about it, and people said, "Well, why do you care? What is it? You know, what's the book like?" I said, "It's the best UFO book that's been written in years. It has nothing to do with UFOs."
You got to talk to Strassman, didn't you?
Yes, I've talked to him a couple of times informally. I've never actually had him on my show. I've asked him a few times, and it's fallen apart both times. Or, you know, he didn't follow up, or I didn't follow up, or whatever. But I'd love to talk to him now and see what he thinks, because he's, as I look at his research and see what he does, and see, you know, what his online presence is, and what sort of keep up with what he's saying, he's gone the same way that Tim Leary did. And, you know, Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, Terrence McKenna, after a while dealing with this stuff, they turn into something that the other scientists would call too spiritual or hippie or whatever. It just happens to them because they can't deny it anymore. They can't deny that there's more than they've been taught in their profession in science, and that science doesn't look at yet. And they take that leap at some point, and they say, "Look, I can't be honest with myself and the people I talk to and everybody I deal with, and not and deny what's happening to me and happening to people around me as a result of this research."
Oh, precisely. Yeah, and there's to me very clearly a parallel. When Rick Strassman, and one of the most interesting things that he talked about, I think, in the book, to me was There'd been a man who had been a practicing, I don't know if he was a monk or just a spiritualist, but, you know, the effects of dimethyltryptamine, the drug that was utilized in this DEA-approved study he did back in the 1990s, of course, you know, it's DMT, it is produced without question within the body. We do not know conclusively where it's produced, but, of course, in the book he espouses that the pineal gland is the source of the production of dimethyltryptamine.
Yeah.
But there was this one guy who said that that the DMT, when administered to him, didn't have much of an effect on him. And he had managed also in meditative states to induce, he said, a kind of a psychedelic experience. And so this led Strassman to wonder about the possibility that some people could actually instigate in what he called an endogenous DMT release within the body.
Yeah.
The words, you literally utilize your physiology and the control, the meditative control of the inner functions of the body to open certain metabolic pathways or channels so as to induce a psychedelic experience through something like focused meditation.
Yeah. People talked about this. Leary talked about this. A few other people, researchers I've talked to, talk about this same thing. Alan Watts said that he had talked to some mystic in India, and he had taken LSD, or he'd say, "Okay, I'll try it." And that they asked him what it was like later, and he said, "Well, there's some visuals, but other than that, it wasn't much different than how things are for me most of the time."
It's so perfect. I love that, you know, because for them, it becomes the norm. And it's kind of interesting because, I mean, I think for a lot of these people, you know, it is also a case where, I think in very loose terms, I think we could even say that you know, the spiritual component of existence that they come to know and recognize and they discuss, it kind of becomes normal for them. In other words, the dream state of reality and awareness is more real than the real waking state that we all come to know and love in our daily existence. So, you know, I find that very interesting because, I mean, again, there are distinct parallels, I think, between these experiences that people say that they have, you know, these weird psychedelic things that people talk about. And then, of course, what we know, popularly, I guess, is the alien abduction phenomenon. It's very hard for me not to see some sort of a parallel between the two.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the listeners wants to call in here and talk to you, so I'll hook it up here in a second. But a few years ago when I can't remember his name, the guy that used to be the head of MUFON for a little while. Oh, I can't. I've had him on my show, too. Anyway, former head of MUFON. Damn it, I can't think of his name. I'll drop it in later before I put up the podcast. But anyway, he was actually communicating with some people as a MUFON group, I believe in the Northwest somewhere, that were trying to get some sort of backing for research with abduction type people and abduction type experiences using DMT specifically designed for that instead of by accident like Rick Strassman had found. And that would be exciting. It'd be a little controversial, but screw that. It would be exciting. Just to see if you tried to induce something like that, what would happen. A la a magical working where you try to bring up some certain spirit. Or as in Valet trying to affect, he apparently, and I have to talk to him at some point if I can, trying to induce some change in the phenomenon that would conform to his influence of it, like trying to influence a phenomenon to go in a certain direction. That would be very interesting, and it would take a very weird oblique way of doing it that I don't even have any idea, but you can see what I'm getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, it wasn't John Lear that you were talking about, MUFON director?
No, it wasn't Lear. It was I can see it's James Carrion.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, he was fascinating to talk to, and he had such cool ideas about MUFON, and then he just stopped, dropped off the map, said, I'm not going to do it anymore. He resigned. And MUFON went back to being exactly what it was before. And I talked to him about, why don't you do some, collect the data and massage it? Do some. We're doing that kind of stuff. We're really excited about that. Why don't you, you know, look into the stuff that Rick Strassman. We're doing that. There's a group in Oregon. And I was like, MUFON is doing this? I don't believe it. And then, bam, he was gone, and they didn't do it anymore. And that's too bad because of their resources. You know, they have more resources than other people, and that's the kind of useful thing they could do, not have a bunch of people come to conferences and talk about the same thing over and over, you know, the newest whatever. Nudge the field in a direction that you think it should be going or that it hasn't tried before. Take a chance and see what happens.
Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, so many of my friends are very negative in their attitude toward MUFON.
Well, I am too, but I want them to do well.
Well, and I'm just like you, honestly. I mean, I want them to do well, but I don't see them doing well.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I wish sometimes that MUFON... You know, I'll be honest, there's so much egotism, really, in not just MUFON. I'm not going to point the finger just at them. It's just in the research community in general, humans in general. I wish, though, that MUFON would be willing to work closely with some of the better researchers in the field who are offering good data, you know. I mean, why couldn't there be an advisory panel, you know, that has serious... serious but balanced perspectives, you know, that help MUFON to make decisions that are, I don't know exactly how it would be implemented. I mean, it's a very complex situation, obviously.
Yeah, it is. When you get people involved, everything gets screwed up because they get political and there's a herd mentality and all that. So, like you said, I have not a very high hope for that. What I have a hope for is a network of like very small groups doing their own research and communicating this quietly by the internet or by some other means.
Yeah.
We got a call here. Do you want to, can you sure. Talk to a listener here? Okay.
Yeah,
just a second. Let me see if I can hook this up right.
Can you hear us, Ryan?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Can you hear Ryan there, Micah?
I certainly can, yeah.
Okay, go right ahead. Sorry to have the phone disconnected till now, but I wanted to get to the end of a couple thoughts. Go ahead, Ryan.
No big deal. Hey, I had talked to Roger Lear several times over the past couple of years because I had heard that he was in Turkey and he saw the Turkey UFO. He was making these comments. So I had contacted him because I wanted to just see what he said, and I had some conversations with him, and he had told me about when he was there that him and a group of people, a lot of them mostly Turkish, stood on the beach there and watched this disc maneuver and hover over the ocean. So I said, "Oh, that's cool. I gotta get into this. I gotta learn more about this." So I said, "Can you send me some of the video?" Because he had copies of the original video, the one that's not on YouTube. So he sent me a CD of that, and so I said, okay, and then he went on to a couple other shows, and thankfully he told me he went on with Knapp, and he went on with a few others. Do you guys know which video I'm talking about?
Do you, Micah?
You know, I don't actually, Ryan, and, you know, I'd actually gotten a message from Ryan before we went on the program, so good to talk to you, by the way.
Big deal.
Yeah, if you can, send that to me, because I actually have not seen that video.
He was, this craft, this disc, I mean, okay, this is so close. This is the reason that the video is interesting. It's not just the light in the sky, because the guy was using a 300, or I think it was a 30 millimeter lens, or 300, no.
Probably 300.
Oh, 300, it was a big lens, and he was able to get, and it had an electronic doubler on the lens, okay? And, these people stood there and watched this, and the video was pretty spectacular. I just wanted to ask you, encourage you, Micah, if you ever wanted to, if you have some spare time, if you would look into it and maybe make a comment about it.
I'd love to do take a look at that. Yeah, I'd gotten a message from Ryan also the other day there. Remind me on the pronunciation of his name. Is it Haktan Akdogan, I believe, that's going to be
right,
in the Ozark?
Right, he's going to be, yeah, if you're going to be at the Ozark conference, he's going to be there, and I encourage you to go up and speak to him and ask him to show you the video, because it's pretty, now, you know, at first I said, well, this has got to be, you know, this is too good to be true, because it is, how much they were able to get close to whatever this thing is, which, you know, the way it acted, it didn't fly away and it didn't fly in. It sort of was there and then it disappeared. It winked in and winked out, sort of. But it there was a four orange lights that were in a semicircle. But at some point, and then at the end, and then in another, there's quite a bit of footage. At nighttime, you see a metallic disc, but when the sun comes up, you see a dog on the beach that's sort of going crazy at the thing. And I said, well, there's got to be some witnesses, because video doesn't really cut it. And so I learned that there was a witnesses. And there's been several interviews that Lear did where he talked about it, and Haktan knows more about it. But it's a pretty, pretty incredible case. I don't know, Greg, have you?
I've heard about the case. I think I've seen some of the video, and it's got to be some pretty damn good video to change anything in regards to all the great video that's been taken of all kinds of strange things in the sky over many years. And I'd really like to hear the background of it to see if it's different than that. And if there's, like you said, some witness interaction that will be, you know, give another dimension to that video footage, because, like I said, one more great shot of a UFO is all it does is make the UFO people happy. It doesn't really excite or bring it to notice to anybody outside of it, which would be, I think, far more important. So, yeah, I'd like to see what the researcher says about that. Actually, I can actually call Feri Ordozu and see what she says, because she's in Turkey. She's Turkish, and I'm sure she knows about the case.
Yeah, well, it was this. It was on a mini DV camera. Okay.
Yeah.
Now this guy that took it, he was working down along the beach or whatever, and now they had a conference there, and this is when Lear was there, and they went out after the conference. So it's a long and tell story, but there's the cassette, the mini DV cassette, was given to the Turkish Scientific and Research Board or whatever in Turkey.
Yeah.
And they thought it was a model or a prop or something like that, or a hoax, and so they looked it over, and they didn't spend a whole lot of time on it, like as long as one could. They only spent like a couple of days on it.
Yeah.
But they came out with a two-page report that said that it was they didn't say it was aliens, or, you know, which nobody really says that, but they said it was that they you know, they couldn't.
They thought it was most likely a hoax,
a string or a prop or anything.
Oh, they
like
couldn't.
That.
Okay.
So anyway, I just wanted to suggest that maybe Hype Mike, if you want to look at it, the one that's from 2009 is probably the best one. It's pretty incredible footage, and I have reason to believe that I just don't think that Roger Lear would make that kind of a story up.
Oh, I don't think he would either. I mean,
right, absolutely, Ryan. Good to talk to you again, and thank you for sending that. If you can send me some information about that, I'd like to look at that. And of course, you know, just to acknowledge.
You probably run across it here and there over the years. It's been kind of ignored. A lot of people don't know about it, which is. And because it just, I think it's a language issue. It was reported in the media over there, but it was sort of ignored here. If you listen to the interview that Lear did with Knapp, in fact, I posted it on your Facebook wall when you had time to listen to that and listen to his, because he described more about it. And now the problem with the video is that there's no really reference point, because it was, a lot of it was taken at night, but there's also something that was taken during the day. Which, you know, there's crowds of people standing on the beach watching the disc or whatever. I mean, it seemed to be interdimensional. It seemed to pop in and pop out. There was a lot of orb plasma phenomenon associated with it. This sort of appeared before and appeared after, and it was all over the sea there. And so, yeah, it's pretty interesting. So that's the reason why I was trying to contact you, and I understand But I don't know how much show you have left.
About 9 minutes.
Well, thanks for taking my call, guys.
Okay, thanks, Ryan. Thanks so much for calling.
And, Mike, you ought to talk to Hawktown when you're there. I think you might find it pretty interesting to talk to.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm going to make a note to do that. He sounds fascinating, and thank you for the hint on that, bud.
Okay, you guys have a good night, man.
Thanks, all right.
Take it easy.
All right, you too. Yeah, are you still there, Micah?
I am indeed, yes, sir.
I don't know. I hope I don't sound cynical and didn't when Ryan was talking, but every time I see a video that says, somebody says, this is the new most exciting thing, I look at it and I say, either that looks fake or that looks impressive. And if it looks impressive, that's as far as it goes. Nobody else cares about it, because whatever evidence you can provide that way is just not going to be accepted by people. Just video won't be accepted. Pictures won't be accepted, especially as of probably 15, 20 years ago.
Right. Exactly. That you know, tends to be the case so often. I think
unless there's something going along with it, with somebody that people really will sit up and take notice about, somebody associated with the case, or somebody with some other corroborating evidence.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think we all keep kind of, you know, maintaining a degree of hope that one day there's going to be something, you know, remarkable maybe that comes about. And maybe there will.
Certainly, yeah. Everybody waits for that. I have very deep doubts, because I think that change is going to come from us, not from the phenomenon.
I tend to agree. I think that, again, the attitude that is applied to the phenomenon has to change before the phenomenon will reveal anything else. Because, I mean, again, you know, I go back to what Ruppelt had said back in 55, 56, you know, he'd written that, you know, we've got some of the best minds that are looking at the UFO problem right now, and I'm convinced within the next few decades we'll know what we're dealing with. Yeah. And what are we looking at? We're looking at century later, and we still really have come no closer to understanding what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because I think our general outlook is still, at least in the greater public mind and in the media and perhaps in academia, which is the only other part of this that will tip the balance, is that we're still dealing in general with 19th century science, I think, and an incomplete understanding of our own psychology, at least as regards to things like the paranormal or some of the things that we don't have an answer for yet. And the things that we don't have an answer for yet that get shoved to the side or made fun of because we just can't explain them yet.
Right. Yeah. And we see that so much. You know, the simple fact that we can't explain something doesn't, you know, to me, provide you know, reasonable grounds for dismissal. You know, I think that unfortunately, so many of us do deal with essentially just that, that there is, in the apparent absence of hard physical proof, grounds for dismissal, you know, is the only other alternative, and that is generally what the modern skeptical attitude toward this subject is. You know, I've wrestled with that just as much as anybody, Greg. You know, and I look at it and I say, look, you know, in the absence of being able to, you know, provide you with metallic slag, you know, or something like that, the kinds of things that Jacques Vallée talked about in his books and that he actually had, for Pete's sake, come on, you know, and yet that this didn't do anything apparently, you know, in its day to further proof any better than anything else. You know, it is really going to take something extreme, and I think that more extreme than presenting proof is changing the attitude and the approach, because quite clearly, you know, we haven't wrapped our minds around the possibilities just yet as to what there may or may not be. And I don't think, frankly, that with the multitude of information that we have, that there is simply nothing, and that this is all a human psychological element that needs to be further examined, and that it all has to do with what people are perceiving. There is certainly a psychological component.
Yeah.
I've made so many people angry when I say that, but I come back to something you said earlier. People, for instance, Jack Puckett seeing what appeared to be a giant rocket ship type thing flying over Florida in 1946, you know, maybe it wasn't a rocket, but maybe to the best of his ability to interpret some phenomena of an aerial variety, of a technological variety, that he observed, maybe his best ability to reconcile with that was to describe a rocket. Who knows, it may not have been a rocket at all. But it is important to consider that there is indeed a psychological component, and to consider the way that interpretation colors perception of the reality of the phenomenon. Whatever there is a reality behind it, but we may not be quite what it seems to be based on what we have perceived.
Yeah, because we're perceiving it with our own instrument. There's something I wrote many years ago called "Are UFOs a Cosmic Art Project?"
I like
and,
that.
Yeah, and you brought up earlier about how people are affected, and I think in the article I said something like, any artist living, any artist ever, would love to be able to affect people in the way that a UFO sighting does. Because it affects them on so many levels. And, you know, and it could change their life. And in fact, many times it has. Can you produce something that changes somebody's life in you know, 30 seconds? I don't think so. So,
which again, you know, begs the whole mystical component to all of this. I mean, yeah. There is very much a mystical, what I, you know, feel is appropriately defined a mystical element that can be appended to the UFO enigma. And I think that, in truth, we have to take that into consideration if we're going to try and really come to terms with what we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
You know, and it gets to a point of being almost blasé. You know, you can say all this so much, you know, well, we got to change this and change that and change that. And I'm just as guilty of looking back at myself from time to time and going, okay, I know we need to change these things. Somebody needs to change these things. You know, he should do it, or he should do it, or they should do it, or whoever should do it. And in truth, the problem that we face is that, you know, nobody seems to be really willing to, well, you know, do it.
So, well, you got an uphill battle here. What you're trying to do is change a perception. You're trying to change somebody's opinion and their perception. And if you try to change anybody's perception, opinion on anything, it's nearly impossible. And, you know, for something as fringy as UFOs, I don't think it is possible, except in the way that you're doing things and Nick's doing things and Valet, Kia, all these people. I'm going to show you what I found. I'm going to show you what I found, who I think the best thinkers are, where I think this could be going, and do what I call cheerleading for it and see how many people catch on to that. I mean, that's all you can do. What else can you do, really, except to say, this is great. Do you want to follow me or come along with me or pull me in a different direction or whatever? Are you interested enough? I think that's all you can do, right?
Maybe so. I mean, you know, if I come up with anything better, I'll be in touch with you. You know, it seems to be a little bit more complex, and yet we continually struggle to try and find that. Oh, this is the next thing we should be doing.
Yeah.
So the greatest complexity again, and it comes back really entirely to what you said, Greg, is, you know, our greatest challenge here is to change our own way of thinking and to change our own way of processing what we perceive as what we're dealing with, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I would hazard a guess that, again, we are dealing with something when we talk about UFOs. I doubt sincerely that we're gonna get to a point where we're just like, oh, ha, it was nothing all along.
Oh, it was nothing but, yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's, again, pretty clearly something going on, but, you know, it may fundamentally require, if not a change, a conscious change, you know, to what extent humans evolve and adapt. It may require whatever the next stage in that development is before we, you know, harness the capabilities of being able to perceive whatever entirely we're dealing with.
Yeah.
Coming to, you know, Whitley Strieber, he had said, what if this is what evolution, the abduction experience he was talking about, what if this is what evolution looks like? As we're experiencing it, you know, and
yeah.
I think that is maybe one of the more profound things ever written about, you know, abduction. And I think we could apply that to UFO just as well.
Yeah.
Maybe it requires the recognition that this is not what it perceives, and that there is, like Valet has also said, a component of it that is trying to control, change, direct, or steer, or even educate us. You know, it may take another step for us before we can fully understand and recognize that for being what maybe these guys have suggested that we are actually dealing with, and maybe what the reality of the situation is.
Yeah, I perceive that you think we're getting to the end here, and we can talk as long as you want because there's not a show after me. If you need to go to sleep or whatever, we got started late. I'm so sorry about that, but if you want to go for another 15, 20 minutes, that's fine by me.
Oh, you know, I'm pretty game for whatever. Before I make that commitment, because I'd be happy to go another 15 minutes, but let me...
Then we can have the standard 2 hours usually or so that I have when I put up the podcast.
I think that we can do that because I don't have an early clear morning. Rather do I?
Now you're getting cut off. Here, it'll come back in. Here it comes.
Oh, great. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Yeah, in addition to the intermittent internet stuff that's been going on, I've been doing a lot of web design and everything, and so my schedule's been more late nights and that sort of thing lately anyhow. So, yeah,
okay, good.
Long story short, yeah, I've got another 15 minutes. Let's go for it.
Okay. Good, because I put questions at the end of here that may have nothing to do with the UFO thing, but I just wanted to ask you, and I haven't asked anybody, a guest this kind of stuff in a long time. It's... The first interview I ever did was with Robert Anton Wilson, and I asked him these questions, and they're really stupid. And the first one of those questions is, what are your favorite movies?
I don't think those are stupid questions.
Well, for somebody that's listening is like, I want to hear what's going on with this paranormal UFO thing. I'm going to ask you what your favorite movies are right now.
that's a really good question.
Because it's a good insight, I think, into people.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's precisely... Precisely. For me, my favorite movies, huh? That's gonna be.
How about five?
Five favorite.
Not necessarily in order, and not necessarily the top five. Makes it a little easier.
Let's see. Yeah, because I mean, well, I should qualify this statement very briefly by first saying that, you know, I don't own a television. I think films are fantastic. I love films because to me, films are art, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't own a television, and. The way that I approach the ocular entertainment because I love radio. I love radio and podcasts, and I see that more and more people do. They love driving down the road, and they love having, you know, kind of the theater of the mind thing going on.
Oh, I love that.
Television, you know, it really is, you know, it'll rot your brains. You know, I'm a lot like, you know, my mom was when I was a kid growing up and everything, you know, and I'm I try to stay away from television if I can. Whereas films, I think, are fantastic. So films that immediately come to mind, and I'll try not to overthink this too much after my qualifying statement there. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, you know, was it Terry Gilliam, I think, was the director, of course.
Yes.
You know, the portrayal of Hunter Thompson by
Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp was really fantastic. Enjoyed that immensely.
Yeah, he's got a new film coming out in like in a month or so, I think.
Terry Gilliam or Johnny does?
Terry Gilliam.
Oh, man, I'd love to see that.
It's called Zero Theorem. It should be out pretty soon. It looks great. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Johnny Depp's got this film coming out here in just a little bit, too, this Transcendence, which is obviously, of course, a singularity-themed film, and it's no doubt, you know, going to arouse a bit of controversy in relation to the discussion of transhumanism and the like. So, you know, I'm eager to see that. I think that actually comes out on my birthday, April 17th. And so, you know, my brother and I, who share the same birthday, we're not twins, born 3 years apart on the same day. Imagine that. Mom and Dad at least did it once a year. So,
yeah.
So we're going to go see that. Who knows if it'll be added to the top five list. You know, aside from that film, yeah, Cops. That's a good one.
Yeah, exactly. Here's your double dose of, and it is a cop, actually, your double dose of Radio Mysterioso Sirens, which means you've been anointed twice now. Go ahead.
I feel good. I've been, you know, there's so many films that I enjoy from the old days. You know, I really am a fan of older films.
Me too.
2001, A Space Odyssey. You know, I'm a huge Kubrick fan.
Me too.
Arthur C. Clarke fan. The first two or three times I tried to watch that film, Greg, I fell asleep. you know, but I still love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I consider 2001 A Space Odyssey to be eye candy. And think of all the elements you've got there. You've got a moon base, the Clavius moon base. You know, you've got Skype calls from Earth to the moon, you know, where the little girl asks for a bush baby.
Yeah. He's got an iPad, apparently, on the ship there on the Jupiter.
Yeah. You've got all kinds of, just all kinds of technology, really. But, I mean, if you, my favorite's obviously being HAL, you know, artificial intelligence. And then, of course, you know, the idea that there was an ancient alien component to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fascinating to see all those things, you know, brought together. And that will remain probably a favorite film of mine.
Yeah.
Apocalypse Now, you know, with Brando. That was a good film, a very long film. It was extremely well done. That one certainly comes to mind, too. And then my final two, you know, it's hard to say. I love Francis Ford Coppola's rendition of Dracula. That was a really good film.
Didn't see that. Haven't seen it.
You know, really, maybe Nick Redfern and I, you know, are supreme horror film junkies. I don't like modern horror films because they aren't fun. They're gross.
Yeah.
They're disgusting, you know. Horror, really, Bram Stoker really kind of just did the best job with that. Genre, you know, the gothic novel and all this and everything.
Yeah.
And for my final film, since it's not maybe, I could name another film, but, you know, I tell you that you shouldn't underestimate television series. Oh, wait, Mikey, you said you don't own a television. Well, again, vintage television series, you know, I have an affinity for old television. And so, you know, rather than a film, my final entry will be two television series.
Cheat away.
Okay, Dark Shadows. I love Dark Shadows. The atmosphere, the elements of, you know, suspense, that gothic presentation. You know, again, this is kind of the essence of what underlies Dracula, aside from the fact that there's this blood-sucking monster. Oh, yeah, wait! And then about 300 episodes into Dark Shadows, we have the same thing with Barnabas Collins, who becomes something of an anti-hero.
Uh-huh.
Incredible. Well, and then I'm an absolute, as of late, this is a new manifestation. I love the vintage Doctor Who, as well as some of the new Doctor Who as well. I never really watched Doctor Who. I never really got Doctor Who.
I still don't. I just haven't given enough of the chance, I guess.
I just never did. And the reason that I did was because You know, at my event that I have done the last couple of years, the Paradigm Symposium, it's kind of a silly thing because Scotty Roberts and John Ward and myself and a number of the other people that attend the event, first of all, it happens in October in Minneapolis, and so sometimes it's usually not cold, but it can be kind of, you know, windy.
It's getting there.
It's chilly. It's well into fall. So a lot of us show up wearing scarves and stuff, and people, you know, I'd always just... You know, I tend to make a character of myself. I don't take myself really, really seriously when I'm out there in public. It's like the essay that Nick Redfern wrote, "Ufologists Don't Do This." And he talks about don't go up there wearing a suit. Well, I'll certainly wear a suit usually the first day of the event, and then my costume there. My suits get more and more ridiculous progressively throughout the course. I don't do that at every event I go to, but certainly do at Paradigm Symposium. And so I just show up, you know, and I'd be wearing like beetle boots, you know, and, you know, skin tight blue jeans or usually black jeans or something. I look like a cross between a punk rocker and like a Time Lord, I guess. You know, I'd be wearing a tie and people would say, "Oh, you must be a big Doctor Who fan." I'm like, "Doctor Who?
Doctor what?
Yeah, exactly.
What are you talking
about?" I never got it. So I finally paid attention to it. And I started, you know, went all the way back to the, you know, the early episodes. And then I really kind of, you know, what really kind of hit it for me was Tom Baker, the actor that portrayed him back in the 1970s. Throughout, I think, from 74 to around 80 or 81, he wore this ridiculously long scarf. Suddenly, yeah. I started realizing why people said, "Oh, yeah, you remind us of this." So, but when you dig into the series, what's really cool is that the themes of artificial intelligence, ancient alien theory, and alien cosmology in general, time travel, I mean, basically all the cool stuff that we as UFO researchers are all into, it's all in the series, even in the modern episodes. So, you know, I find that although I'm still kind of new to the Whovian universe,
yeah,
I find it to be a program that if you're interested in Fortiana, there's a lot of it in that program, maybe more than any other sci-fi series I've found.
Yeah. Okay, how about books? How about 5 books, UFO or otherwise?
Yeah, that might be easier than...
I knew it'd be easier. You know, we all definitely have our lists.
You know, when it comes to books, you know, there were a number of books that I was given up when I was a kid. One of them that was really interesting, this isn't a UFO book. It was Ivan Sanderson's Abominable Snowman, Legend Come to Life. Here, it was a Scottish zoologist who had traveled the world, and he put together in the 1950s, I think, or maybe the 60s, what I think today remains one of the finest presentations on relic hominids that are alleged to still exist, i.e. Bigfoot or Abominable Snowmen of America, as they were called back then, and then the actual Yeti or Abominable Snowmen of the Himalayas. That book is really good, and here in a more or less ufological discussion, my first two books are going to have to do with cryptozoology. That
great
book is great because it states the problem. And then around 1972 or 3, John Napier, the primatologist, head of the primatology department at the Smithsonian at the time or immediately before this, he wrote a book called Bigfoot. And John Napier, he was the skeptic, but he wrote one of the best skeptical presentations on the subject and resolved at the end of the book, while I can't substantiate the reports and the claims of snowmen, he says, "I'm convinced based on the circumstantial evidence that there's something with Bigfoot," which I just found to be a fascinating statement if you think about it. I mean, here's this quote unquote skeptic coming forward and saying, yeah, in all likelihood we really have something. And speaking of skeptics who have written on these subjects and who have done a better job articulating the actual substance of the argument rather than taking away from it, Arthur Koestler, anyone who's never read the book The Roots of Coincidence, I highly recommend that.
I've got to read it. I've had it for probably 10 years now. It's still sitting on the shelf.
It's a short, quick read, but yeah. Koestler, you know, again, his biography that Dr. Michael Scannell wrote about Koestler, of course, it focuses on darkness at noon and, of course, you know, his political writings and whatnot. But,
yeah,
you know, it spends more time talking about Koestler's affinities for women and affairs than it does his genuine interest in parapsychology. But the thing is that Koestler left his estate when he and his wife, he, of course, died for season, so he and his wife ended their lives in a suicide pact, but they left the Koestler estates to the foundation of a parapsychological unit for a college.
Yes, it's the Koestler chair, is it not?
Yeah, and they literally, I mean, it's kind of like a Ryan Institute, you know, that's in, I believe, in Scotland. I think it's in Scotland.
Yeah.
But anyway, So the point is, you know, here is this man whose biography defines him as, you know, a modern skeptic, you know, the epitome of the modern skeptic. He was. But he was the good kind of a skeptic. He was the kind of skeptic who did ask the hard questions, but who didn't rule out the possibility, and whose fascination fueled him throughout the last years of his life, and more intelligently than probably any writer before him or maybe since on those subjects. And as a brief aside, there's an essay. This wasn't an actual book, but anyone who would like to see what Kessler had to say about UFOs, look up UFOs, A Carnival of Absurdity, I think is what it's called. It's in the appendix to his book, Janus. And, you know, he deconstructs the Condon Committee fiasco incredibly well in that book. So, yeah, so I would say The Roots of Coincidence, as well as the two aforementioned cryptozoology books. You know, I really think that any of the Alien Contact trilogy books by Jacques Vallée are fantastic, but I must highly recommend Confrontations. That's where it all comes together. And then he just gets just pissed in that third one, Revelations, and gets really super skeptical. And again, you know, Jacques Vallée, one of the world's lead UFO advocates and experts, to hear his brand of skepticism is a breath of fresh air, and it's just fantastic. And then maybe as a departure from the UFO books and things, you know, the final book I'll have to list, a fiction novel called The Descent by Jeff Long. There was a horror film made by a British production company, and it was a major motion picture release. I saw it in theaters, and it scared the hell out of me. The film was based on that, but while the film was entertaining as a scare fest, the book, if you can imagine combining the Shaver mystery with the Da Vinci Code, that's what The Descent is.
I've never heard of it. That sounds great. Now I got to check it out.
You can get it for $2 in any used bookstore in paperback, or grab it on Amazon.com for a penny used. It's The Descent by Jeff Long. Please read that book. It is one of the finest works of modern horror and suspense fiction. It's not really a horror book,
yeah,
but it's the Fortean overtones are just innumerable, and you would really enjoy that, Greg.
Sounds like it would. I got to go pick it up. I think that's what I wanted to ask you about, your favorite stuff. I mean, and the thing is that most people ask you about, what's your favorite UFO book? Well, just, you know, in general. So that's cool. Are there any that you haven't read that you think that might be really important that you want to read?
I was having this conversation about, and I actually own the book and I have read some of it, so this doesn't really necessarily constitute I haven't read it, but if I haven't finished a book, I you know, would categorize them under, you know, still needs to be read, and that is The Day After Roswell by Philip DeCorso, because I have so many issues with that book.
Yes, I read it when it came out, and I had a ton of issues with it. I got more now.
And there's this great video that Carol Rainey, the late ex or the late wife
of the ex-wife of the late Bud Hopkins.
There we go. That's what I was trying to say. Precisely. Of course, a lot of people, you know, who were Bud fans don't like Carol all that much because there'd been some bad blood there toward the end. But
yeah, she played a
video where Bud Hopkins plays the skeptic and really goes after Corso in this video.
Yeah, I've heard about this.
It's really good, and it's really anyone who wants to say that, oh, Bud didn't know what he was doing his last few years, he was just willing to write anything. No. You know, Bud maybe had his flaws and his downfalls with what he did, but he was truly, truly, truly looking for the answers and was at times more than willing to ask the hard questions. And, you know, just seeing his interactions with Philip Corso, it's just incredible. And it further solidifies in most of our minds that maybe you shouldn't take everything at face value. I was talking with a good friend of mine earlier today who was saying, no, Micah. He says, you know, the Corso book is the epitome of the UFO, ufological books, you know, and the information that, you know, really is going to tell us what's going on. And I'm
God,
thinking,
I hope not.
I'm thinking, yeah, exactly. You know, Corso, it's not to doubt what that book presents, which was essentially ghostwritten by Bill Burns, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that's nothing against Bill Burns. You know, I've known Bill for off and on for years, you know, but the point is that, you know, Philip didn't really write that book. Given the circumstances of how the book was essentially rushed out to meet the whatever anniversary of Roswell and all this stuff.
Yeah, he was at the 50th anniversary, and I met Corso there, and he is a very nice guy, but I don't agree with the book.
It's nothing against Corso or Bill Burns. It's just that, you know, the circumstances which led to the authorship of that book may not have actually been conducive to, you know, a serious, what I would call a serious study in the realm of the ufological
Yeah. There was one thing I was thinking about in the car on the way here and earlier. There seems to be a lot of attacking of people these days. Like attack, I don't know, just anybody. Let's say attack Richard Dolan because you don't think he's very well supported in a lot of things, in some of his things. But it goes to the point of like pathological attacks on people. And these people are full of crap and they should be thrown away with the rest of the garbage. And it's like, whoa, why are... I don't understand the incredible, what's the word, emotion associated with being skeptical about people in you know in the UFO field or any paranormal field, because if it's that unbelievable, why should you care?
It's a good question.
You know, but why do you care so much? Why, you know, to me it sounds like religious zealotry. If you don't believe what I believe, there's a problem. I have to make you believe what I believe.
You know, I won't go too terribly into debt, into depth about that.
That's not even a question. I'm just saying it seems kind of, it bothers me a bit.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course, yeah. I was recently attacked on the Above Top Secrets forum following a Coast to Coast AM appearance. It was a funny post, and I have to say, I think anyone who says that they don't have ego is full of it, you know.
Everybody does. What are you talking about?
You know, yeah, I have an ego, and I recognize that. And I'm, you know, it's just that I try because I see the way that so many people, and having worked with, you know, I mean, it's one thing if you can say, oh, yes, somebody respects my research and all this stuff. I've worked with a lot of big names in this field, and it's not because they have any genuine respect for my research. It has more to do with the fact that I've, you know, co-planned conferences and worked for, you know, people at their others. I'm going to be at the UFO, Ozark Mountain UFO Conference in April, working with AGRE Radio Network. And when you do something like that, you get to work with a lot of these people and you get to meet some of these people that Ryan called in and talked about and whatnot, you know.
Yeah.
So I've been around a lot of people, and some of them are incredible. Some of them are great people. Some of them are the epitome of professionalism. Some of them, you know, are like, you know, babies with wet diapers, you know.
Yes. Just like any group of people.
Exactly, and that's just human nature. And so the thing is that the more of that I experience, you know, the less cheerleading and silliness I try to engage in, and the more just, you know, I just try to suppress my own ego in relation to what I'm trying to do as a researcher and not get involved in these heated little conflicts and things. Well, somebody goes up on the Above Top Secret forums and everything, and I preface all that, you know, and gave you this little precursor beforehand, simply to illustrate the fact that I really am not offended by people having differences in opinion from mine and even attacking me and saying absurd things. But it is the level of absurdity that's humorous. Some of the accusations against me were, where did this Micah Hanks guy come from? All of a sudden, he's on Coast to Coast the other night. He's got a book. He's got three podcasts. It's like he just appeared. Conspiracy.
Yes.
Know? And I'm like, well, you know,
oh,
I don't
you
know
should
where
be I'm honored.
At. Yeah, exactly right. You know, and that's the whole thing is that, yeah, wow, somebody's paying attention to you enough that they want to, you know, grill you. And so people came and they were defending me and everything. They're like, you know, no, Mike has been around for, you know, like a decade now, writing and you know, studying and everything. He's not like some, you know, some new guy. Which really, in the, you know, long term, I'm extremely new, extremely green. But and
we all are.
Said, and the. Yeah, the person said, well, you know, it's fine. It, you know, I don't care where he's from and I hope he does well. But don't give me this bull about I'm just doing it for the research. He's just trying to sell books like anybody else. And don't lie to me and say that you're not, Hanks. And I'm thinking, again, to quote Red Pill Junkie, if I were just trying to make money, there are 100 things I could do.
Yeah.
100 things. I could be an earthworm farmer. I could be a professional, you know, nude model. I could probably give blood. I could give blood several times a week, or as much as I'm allowed. I have made in the last month just being a UFO researcher, folks. You know, I do other things, you know, including in addition to writing and researching and broadcasting and stuff like that. I'm also a musician.
Yeah.
I pull it all together somehow, you know, in the long run. But, you know, I don't think that anybody who's a full-time UFO researcher... First, I don't know if there are many full-time UFO researchers, and if they are, I wonder if they're really seriously researchers.
Yeah, because they have to play to a market, and after a while, you don't even realize that that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Yes, precisely. So, you know, and I hope that that's not misconstrued by anyone as me being bitter, because it's not. You know, I mean, I wish everyone the best, and I really do, and I hope that we all find the individual answers to whatever questions we're each individually seeking. But, you know, yeah, you're right, Greg. There's just a lot of infighting and silliness. I mean, real silliness going on in terms of, you know, what people could be doing with their time, you know, the productivity that they could be achieving, and instead they decide to commit to this silliness and bickering and infighting and whatnot, you know. And this is, again, why it doesn't really bother me, is because, you know, it's entertaining, I have to admit.
Yes, definitely.
By the same token, you know, I'm saddened, and I don't want to do the same thing and become guilty of the same crime and waste time reading the negativity.
Okay, now can you still hear me? Because you cut out right after you said negativity.
I can indeed, yes. And I think I was pretty close to completion of that idea. So,
okay, you just don't want to waste time with negativity that's floating around and people engage in. I think a lot of people engage in it because that's how they make their name, by pulling other people down. And I see this a lot too, and I see it amongst people that are skeptical as well, or say they're skeptical. And it's a lot of noise. I was talking to my mom yesterday, strangely enough, and she said, you know, if somebody's bothering you, you should just, you know, not, you know, don't feed it. And I said, well, you just ignore them, because it's no fun. In fact, most of the people that really want to engage you, if you ignore them long enough, they just stop. I had one of those people on UFO Mystic. I didn't answer him for probably about 2 months, and he finally stopped posting, because it would just be one of those things where they would fight for the sake of fighting. And if you backed them into a corner, they'd just change the argument to something else. It's like, that's not what we were talking about originally. Yes, it was. No, it wasn't. Yes, it was. Bye.
You, sir, are wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and it also narrows down how many people I want to talk to on my show, you know? So, you know, it becomes harder and harder, because people say, why don't you have this person on your show? Why don't you have this other person on your show? If I find out about them and I think they're interesting, fine. But if it's somebody that, you know, that's just going to come on and tell me I have the answer, or you're wrong, sir, or whatever, I don't learn anything from those people. I mean, in these 2 hours I'm sitting here talking to you, I've learned two or three more things that I didn't know before, and found things that I need to check up on. That's wonderful. That's why I do the show. I'm sure that's why you do what you do.
Well, I've learned, as I always do, from being around you, Mr. Bishop, and that is why I do it. I love being able to, you know, to catch up with people. I hope you and I get to actually catch up, you know, have dinner, really talk, you know, do that at some point, and I'm sure we will. It's just a matter of time. You know, I've had Mike Clellan here in the Grayling Bunker before, and in addition to a few other researchers, you know, I've sat in a hotel room and done a radio show with Rich Dolan and gone out and had drinks after the fact, and... Yeah, that's what
Rich is fun for drinks. I've had beers with him a few times.
Richard is wonderful. Richard Dolan, I love the man to death. He's one of the best people, you know.
I don't agree with him, but I think he's a nice guy. He's a really cool guy. He didn't know me from Adam when I first met him, and I had to check out of my hotel room, and him and Karen said, "Oh, put your stuff in our room. We don't mind. Go ahead." It's like, "What? I just met you 5 minutes ago."
Legitimate, and that's what's really great, you know. And you know, that's the beauty of this field, is that, you know, I'm sure that there are things that Richard and I don't agree about. And it's funny, because the revelatory moment was, I think, the day after he and I met. We were at the UFO Congress together last year, and he and I were talking about let's go grab a beer, you know, let's go hang out a little bit or go get dinner. And this gentleman came out who was a big Rich Dolan fan, and he was not a big Micah Hanks fan. This guy didn't like me. And He comes over, he goes, "Well, you two are the last two people I'd ever expect to see hanging out together, since you don't agree with anything."
Yeah. And cognitive, like, dissonance immediately.
Yeah. And Richard goes, why do you think we don't agree? I think Mike and I agree about everything. I think Rich was probably just playing with him more than anything. You know, yeah. Any UFO researcher that I agree with wholeheartedly, 100% completely, is going to bore me to tears. I'm not going to have as much fun with ones that I agree with completely. You know, give me somebody who I can fight with. I don't really fight, but the truth
no,
is...
No, no. You go have a big discussion and go have a beer later, or, you know, have it during the beer. That's some of the most fun things that I can think you can do. If in any field, have a horrible, big, drag-out disagreement about something, then go talk about other stuff that you both are into, and buy each other beers. It's so civilized. It's wonderful.
It is, yeah. I'm glad that we've got that, you know, method that we can apply to things these days as opposed to the old way, you know, pole arms and javelins and knocking each other off horses.
And, you know. This is the realm of the gentleman, sir.
That's a lot, you know, since those days, Greg.
Or at least, that, you know, the kind of people I want to hang out around with, I don't have to agree with them. I don't agree with Don Ecker on a lot of stuff.
Sure.
I, you know, especially politically, even though I don't really talk about political stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't care. He's always been really nice to me. I've been on his show, and he's like, in the middle of a sentence, he'll say, "I think that's bullshit, Greg." And I think it's hilarious that he says that. It doesn't bother me. I say, "Really, Don, tell me how you really feel." And then we hash it out, and then, you know... then we, you know, go hang out and have a drink somewhere, or, you know, him and his wife and I and my wife go and do something.
He's an extremely intelligent guy. You know, he's the kind of guy who can be opinionated on things, and you agree or you don't, but you love to hear him.
Yeah.
Regardless.
And plus, he's changed his opinion about stuff over the years, which some people never do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's fundamental. If you're going to really be a serious researcher of anything, you have to accept that things change.
Yeah. Yeah.
Data changes, and your interpretation from time to time is going to be different from what it was when you came to this at the outset.
Yeah. It is 1:30 in the morning for you. I think I'm going to let you go to sleep because you've been so kind staying on even 15 minutes past the 15 minutes that we said we're going to stay on. So I think we should talk anyway off the air at some point, and I hope... You know what? You said you should accept one of those TV things because it brings you out here. Nick does that, so I get to see him about once or twice a year.
Oh, I'll do that then. Yeah, that way we can catch up. If I can do it, I'll work it out so I coincide with one of Nick's visits, and we'll all catch up.
Yeah, and if it's on a Sunday, we'll just all come in the studio and yak for 2 hours.
Oh, it would be delightful. You know, if I'm going to be out that way for any reason, I'll do that.
All right, cool. That'd be great. Well, thanks so much, Mike. It's been way too long since we talked on the show, and we could go on for another 2 hours. At least I think we could. And we shall at some point. So thanks so much, and keep in touch, and great talking to you again.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Uh-oh. Of course, now right at the end, you get cut off again.
It seems every time that there's a honking or something like that, it overrides the Skype. So, but anyway, yeah. Always my pleasure. If anybody wants to get in touch with me and kind of figure out a little more about what I do and everything, graylianreport.com. Some big changes there at the site right now. And, of course, you know, I'm working on some even cooler stuff that that people will be able to enjoy. But there's that site and then MicahHanks.com. Email me, info@MicahHanks.com. I'm always really happy to hear from people when I have time. I try to answer every email. I don't always get to all of them, and I feel bad. But, you know, there's only so much time in the day. And I'll leave you with this, Greg.
Mm-hmm.
Words of David Lee Roth, if you gave me a 36-hour day, we could play catch-up. So with that, I bid you adieu, my friend.
All right. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon, Micah.
Yeah, let's get in touch, okay?
Please. Absolutely.
See you, bud.
All right. See ya. Okay, Micah Hanks. That was fun. That was a fun show to do after not having done a show for a little while. Thanks again, Micah. I will post this as quickly as I possibly can. I've got Kurt Collins. Oh, I forgot to bring up something that Kurt Collins said online today on Facebook. He said, we were talking about a fundamentalist skeptic type reaction to something that he'd written. He said, isn't it strange that psychologists don't ask people to talk about their beliefs in UFOs when they walk into the office? Absolutely perfect statement. And I hope Micah hears that if he listens back to the show. I will see you, be with you, at least on the radio, next week. Thanks, Ryan, for calling in. Thanks for contacting me online and bringing up that video. Maybe something will come of it. Who knows? Ready, Mysterioso.
Red shark, on the rise, red shark, close your eyes, take me well. country.